Doug hesitated, digesting not only Takai's words but their tone.
He knows more than he's willing to tell me, Doug realized.
Don't you think Japan would recognize our independence if we drove off the peacekeepers?
No, I don't.
Is Yamagata against us? I need to know, Toshi. Lives depend on it.
Takai said nothing.
Well?
Doug demanded.
The pained expression on Takai's face showed the tension he was feeling.
My instructions are to continue as usual.
We will operate Nippon One as we normally do, despite your present difficulties.
They both knew that Nippon One carefully refrained from using nanotechnology. Instead of using nanomachines to extract helium-3 from the ground, they used cumbersome bulldozers and old-fashioned mass spectrometers to separate the isotope from the other lunar ores. It kept the cost of helium-3 at least 10 times higher than it would have been if nanomachines had been employed to ferret out the helium-3 nuclei individually. But Nippon One bought its water from Moonbase. Shut down Moonbase, and the Japanese base dies too.
I don't understand how that can be, Doug said.
Those are my instructions.
Walking beside his virtual friend in silence, Doug thought, he wants to tell me what's going on, but he can't. His loyalty to Yamagata is preventing him from telling me the whole truth.
We've already declared our independence, you know, Doug said.
Yes, you told me.
I doubt that it'll do you any good.
What was Tokyo's reaction to that?
No reaction. The first I heard of it was just now when you told me.
Your corporate superiors didn't tell you about it?
Not one word.
We beamed the information to Yamagata headquarters and to every news agency on Earth.
I have not received any information about that, Takai said, genuinely upset.
That must mean that Foray intends to ignore our declaration and proceed as if it's a non-starter.
Yes, of course.
They took a few more paces across the crater floor, skirting a fresh-looking craterlet about the size of a beach ball's indentation.
Toshi, how are you going to get water if Moonbase is shut down?
You can't use nanomachines, and we will get our water the same way we do now.
But Moonbase will be closed. The peacekeeper troops are on their way to shut us down.
Takai grimaced, struggling inwardly.
At last he said, the peacekeepers are coming to remove you and your people from the management of Moonbase. That does not mean they intend to close the base entirely.
Doug stopped in his tracks. Not... His mind started spinning.
Not close the base?
Toshi, are you sure?
It could cost me my position if anyone learns that I told you.
Yes, I am quite certain.
Or I should say that Tokyo is quite certain.
They're not going to close the base?
Foray spoke directly to the head of the Yamagata clan himself and assured him that Moonbase will continue to supply water to Nippon One after the peacekeeper troops remove you and your staff from the base.
Foray intends to continue running Moonbase, Doug repeated, feeling hollow with surprise.
The little furball doesn't care about the nanotech treaty. He wants to control Moonbase himself.
Touchdown minus 93 hours, 45 minutes.
But don't you understand what this means? Joanna demanded.
It means that Foray wants to take over Moonbase, said Doug.
It means we can do business with him, his mother replied eagerly. We can cut a deal.
Doug stared at his mother. She was sitting bolt upright in the chaise longue she had brought from her home in Savannah as part of the elaborate furnishings for her two-room suite at Moonbase. Leaning toward her from the delicate little Sheraton sofa on which he sat, Doug shook his head unhappily.
Foray won't make any deals. He intends to use the peacekeepers to toss us out of here and then have the UN itself run the base.
Joanna gave her son a pitying smile.
Doug, he'll need trained personnel to run this base. He'll have to use the people who are here.
That doesn't include thee and me.
Don't be so sure, Joanna said.
She seemed actually happy with Doug's news, pleased that Foray wanted to take over Moonbase.
He'll want to continue to manufacture clipper ships, of course, Joanna mused. That's where the profits are. Every transportation line on Earth wants our clipper ships, and he can pump the profits into the UN.
Or his own pocket.
Maybe, Joanna agreed. Even better. The more venal he is, the easier it'll be to deal with him.
Doug shook his head again. That's what the German industrialists thought about Hitler.
Faure's no Hitler. He's not a fanatic. He isn't even going to stop our nanomachines. He just wants to run them for his own profit.
Getting to his feet, Doug said, I'm still assuming that we'll have to handle the peacekeepers, and we've got less than 4 days to figure out how to do it.
What do you intend to do?
He shrugged. I've asked Zimmerman and Cardenas to meet me in my quarters. Lev and Ginny Anson, too. And one of the aquaculture technicians, the only guy in the base who's had any military experience at all.
All right,
Joanna said, looking up at her son from the chaise longue.
You do that. I'm going to put in a call to Faure. He'll negotiate. I know he will.
Don't commit us to anything until I get a chance to see what it is, okay? Joanna nodded absently.
Oh, I don't think Faure will agree to anything concrete until the peacekeepers get here and take over the base.
That's what I'm trying to prevent.
Good,
she said.
If we could somehow keep the peacekeepers out of here, it would strengthen our hand tremendously.
I'll see what we can do, said Doug.
Touchdown minus 90 hours, 11 minutes. Moonbase had started as a clutch of temporary shelters, little more than aluminum cans the size of house trailers, dug into the lunar regolith on the floor of the crater Alphonsus, and then covered over with rubble to protect them from the radiation and temperature swings between night and day, and from the occasional meteoroid strike. Meteor showers that were spectacular light shows in the night sky of Earth were potentially dangerous volleys of celestial machine gun fire on the airless moon. By the time of Doug Stavanger's first visit to the moon, on his 18th birthday, Moonbase had grown into a set of four parallel tunnels dug into the flank of Mount Jaeger. Offices, labs, workshops, and living quarters lined the tunnels. The water factory was at the front of one tunnel, the environmental control center, where the base's air was recycled and kept circulating properly, was at the rear. In his 7 years at Moonbase, Doug had seen those original four tunnels grow to eight, with the four new tunnels sunk a level below the original quartet. Rough rock walls were smoothed with plasma torches and painted in pastels selected by psychologists, then painted over by base personnel who demanded brighter, bolder colors, and the occasional graffitist. When the Grand Plaza's construction was finished, 20 more tunnels would be added beneath it.
If we ever get to finish the Grand Plaza, Doug thought as he walked toward his quarters.
He nodded and smiled automatically to everyone he passed. Doug knew most of the longtime lunatics by sight, but there were always hundreds of short-term workers at the base. How many of them will stay with us, he wondered. Even if we keep the peacekeepers out and establish our independence, will we have enough people left here to run the base? There were directional signs on the walls now, and electronic maps at intersections that showed a schematic of the tunnel system. Corridors, Doug reminded himself. We call them corridors now, not tunnels. He turned left at an intersection and bumped into a man in olive-green coveralls who was striding purposefully down the corridor. They each muttered an apology and fell into step, side by side, as they walked down the corridor. Out of the side of his eye, Doug looked the man over. He thought he recognized him, but couldn't quite place who he was. The man was a couple of inches shorter than Doug's own 6'1", but built wide and solid like a bulldozer. Not an ounce of fat on him. He had felt iron hard when Doug had bumped into him. His skin was the color of milk chocolate. His neatly trimmed hair dark and wiry. Doug could not see his name tag without making it obvious he was looking at it. So he said, I'm Doug Stavanger, and stuck out his hand without breaking stride. The man made a perfunctory smile. I know. For a moment, Doug thought he was going to refuse to shake, but then the man took Doug's proffered hand and said, in a clear, distinct, deliberate baritone, My name is Bam Gordet.
Leroy Gordet?
Suddenly the picture from the personnel file clicked in Doug's mind. Gordet replied, Call me Bam. It's short for Bama, which in turn is short for Alabama.
You're from Alabama? Doug asked.
Yeah, but I got no banjo on my knee.